We are here today with Thomas Sterner, who is the founder and CEO of the Practicing Mind Institute and the author of a really incredible book called The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I am so thrilled that you have agreed to speak to us today, because when I found your book on Amazon, I was so excited. It's just an amazing, amazing book. And what I love about it is that it's very counterintuitive to the way that we talk about goals and accomplishing things in our lives, you know, because we live in a very goal-driven society, and we're always told to look at that endpoint and put all our time and attention and energy focusing on that. But you recommend changing our relationship to our goals and shifting our focus to the process, which, as I said before, is kind of radical. So tell us about that and how you came to that realization.
Well, the realization came from a number of things. One was many years of studying both Eastern thought systems and also looking at what all of the studies, the empirical Western studies, are showing in terms of what they call peak performance, performance enhancement psychologies. And most of these things originated in the sports arena, particularly in sports like golf, which are very mental, and things happen much slower than they do in say, football or basketball. So, you know, they've been trying. Because of the way the computers have worked now, we can really look at athletic moves in a very refined detail. And so I think we've gotten to a point where we've peaked in that. We know what a perfect golf swing looks like. We know we can watch somebody shoot a foul shot or something, and we can look at their form in slow motion and all that sort of thing. So after that, the next frontier was to figure out, well, if somebody has a perfect golf swing or if somebody has perfect form, why don't they make the shot every time? So they started to do all this research, and of course they found out that it's what's going on in between the years. So these things have proven all of this out. So I will say that that's all been documented. The research is out there if any of the listeners want to pursue that. But so you don't have to do that. I just made that point, and I will tell you that in a more conversational way, that when we create a goal, the goal should it should serve as a rudder. It shouldn't serve as a something that reminds us of what we have left to do. And the reason for that is because when we start to focus on the end point, on the goal, our mind is not on what we're doing right now. And there's a lot of emotions that go with that. And our energy is very scattered and dispersed. So we're not actually putting our energy into what we're doing. And that's the paradox, because we feel if we become more present moment, if we become more process oriented, where all of our energy is going into doing what we're doing right now, that in some way we're not driven. And I think that that's taught to us by the media. So we feel like we have to be in this state of mind where we're constantly reaching for the goal, and otherwise we don't have the drive that we need to accomplish our goal. But actually what that does is slow down the amount of time that it takes us to achieve a goal, and it also makes the process, the experience of achieving the goal, very unpleasant. So we have found that you know, the most economical expenditure of energy and the least stress and the most efficient way to reach a goal, which could be a financial goal, a job goal, or developing a skill, is to be process-oriented, to be much more involved in the process. And I would also say, from an enjoyment standard, most people don't, I should say an enjoyment point of view, most people don't actually experience the process, all the enjoyment that they have in actually acquiring their goal, because they're so focused on this endpoint. So we miss out on a lot which could serve as motivation as we're going. So that's the reason why you know, it's not only that I'm saying this, it's that the empirical data that's out there has said, look, we've looked at all this, we've looked at all different ways of how the mind works and how we maintain our focus the best, and if we can stay in the present moment and we can stay processed, then that's what we're saying. When we say stay in the present moment, then what we're doing is we're focusing on the process of what we're doing to achieve our goals. So that's the reason why it's much more effective in goal accomplishment.
Well, you know, there's so much in what you said there, and I want to pull out a couple different points. One is that the idea that the goal is the rudder, and that, you know, somehow, you know, it's meant to give us direction, but in our sort of monofocus on it, we end up separating ourselves from the present moment and the process. And of course, we're also separated from the goal, right? Because we're not there yet. So we're left with this whole kind of stew of emotions, usually frustration, impatience. I know I see that a lot in my coaching clients. I mean, I see it a lot in myself, frankly, as well. So how, when we step away from that and we start to say, all right, let me use my goal as a rudder, you know, and we're kind of deposited back into present moment, you know, how do we manage those emotions, what's going through our minds as we kind of settle into the process?
Well, the end of that equation is that once we experience the release from anxiety and from a feeling of incompleteness that comes from being in the process, it pretty much takes care of itself.
Okay.
Because at that point we realize that, you know what, I'm enjoying my day and my life so much more when I'm operating under this paradigm than I am under this other paradigm, which is a leftover paradigm from when we didn't know that this was more effective. But to your point, you still have to get to the point where you've experienced that several times. And, you know, I tell people that you can't be, in order to change something, in this context, your experience of being process-oriented, you have to be separate from the emotions that you're having during that time. Otherwise, you're just absorbed in the emotion. So I think an emotion that would be very common in this discussion would be a sense of impatience. I want to get to the goal. And, you know, if you are not aware that you're feeling impatient, you're just in your impatience, then you really don't have a choice in terms of, well, how do I change the way that I feel? And that's kind of the conundrum, you know, is that you have to get to a point where you're actually more aligned with this person, this part of your personality that is an observer to this, than the person that's actually sucked into the emotions. And there's two components to that. One is that in order to get this awareness, and this is, again, you know, what studies have shown, is that the only real way to do that is to have some sort of practice of quietude. You can call it thought management, thought awareness, meditation. I don't really care what you call it. But you have to spend a certain amount of time in your day. Not a whole lot of time. I mean, this has been talked about in many areas today. And it's at one point in time, if you go back 30 years ago, it would probably be an uncomfortable subject. But in today's world, it's so accepted that things like meditation are beneficial on health, from a health perspective, from many different perspectives. So what happens when you, quote, meditate, or you sit quietly in a chair for 10 minutes in the morning and you just try to stop thinking? And by the way, in some of the Asian cultures, this is actually figured into their business day, where they take 30 minutes in the middle of the day to sit down and work at stopping their thought process.
Wow.
From going on. So basically stopping the hamster wheel.
Oh, that's
because
so interesting.
They've learned that this increases their focus so much. So when you do this, what happens is, and it's quite subtle at first, is that you become much more aware of the thoughts that your mind is producing. And so instead of actually just being in your thoughts, being anxious, you know, anxious is, it starts with a thought. You have an anxious thought, and then there's emotions that are created from this thought, and you can either just be totally absorbed in that anxiety or that sense of impatience, or you can be separate from it and say, you know what, this is interesting, I'm having an anxious thought. And for the general public, this is like, no, that can't be. Well, yes, it can be, and you just have to experience it, which is what I said earlier. Once you begin to experience this being process-oriented in the moment, a mind that's not moving with a whole bunch of thoughts, because thoughts are always generated by anxiety and impatience and frustration. That's a very active mind. When you begin to feel that, then you begin to realize there's a whole nother side of you that you haven't tapped into. And that comes, the beginning of that comes from being still and practicing this. And it doesn't have to be a lot. You know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes a day, what will generally happen is once you start to do that, you will want to do it more because you will see how this empowers you. The second component is you have to take the time to sit down when you're in a calm state of mind and come up with some sort of a procedure that you're going to drop into when you begin to have these feelings that you don't want to have, because who wants to feel impatient? I certainly don't. So instead of just reacting to a situation and being sucked into this impatient feeling, let's come up with, first, we want to be able to separate ourselves from, so we can recognize, oh, here I go, I'm starting to feel impatient. Now you all of a sudden you have this power. You have the power of choice. But what are you going to do with that power of choice? If you don't have anywhere to go with that power, then what will happen is you'll lose that moment and you'll get sucked back into feeling impatient. So I tell people you really need to have a procedure to drop into so that you can practice that in your mind so that you have something to go to. And, you know, quite frankly, this is why they teach EMTs, people in emergency situations, pilots. I have a pilot's license. They go over, they create these procedures that are written out and that are well thought out so that when you're in a situation that becomes stressful, you have the opportunity to first recognize the situation, and then you don't have to figure out, what am I going to do in this situation? It's already been done. It's something you've gone over in your mind, and now you have something to grab a hold of to keep you from dropping into whatever the emotion is that you don't want to experience. And this is really a part of performing at your best without experiencing all the drama that can happen in those situations. So I tell people, you know, first, got to get the awareness to get you out in front. And then once you have that awareness and you've got that time to react, what are you going to do with it? Well, now you need to figure out, what do I want to do with that? You know, how do I want to handle this? And you can look at this in all sorts of things, you know, whether you've got somebody at work that just pushes your buttons, a certain type of thing like being worried about money. You know, it's not that being worried about money, if you just take that example, is not a legitimate concern. It's just that the worrying doesn't do anything to alleviate the situation. It just makes the experience of the situation miserable. So there is no argument for worrying about money is a good thing. It's never productive. So what we want to do, and if we can just let go of that and say, yeah, it doesn't mean, we're not talking about whether your situation is fair or unfair or any of that. We're talking about, how do I effectively operate in the situation that is going to be the most pleasant, most productive, and help me to get through that? And that's, you can't do that if you're not out in front of those feelings and that if you don't have a plan.
Well, you know, that's kind of, when people say that you can't solve the problem on the same level that it was created, that's kind of that. What they're saying really is that you've got to separate your mind, like you've got to put your mind into a different space in order to resolve that issue. That if you are stuck in the morass of emotions and anxiety and everything, you will not have the mental space to solve it, you know, apart from it just being a completely unpleasant experience, but that the solutions sit in that space. So I want to circle back and ask you a question about the procedure. So I completely understand this idea of, you know, there's a moment where we have an opportunity to observe that we're having a particular feeling, say anxiety. And then if we don't know where to go in that moment, then we're going to get sucked back in. But if we have some kind of procedure, then we can continue to be separate and maybe go down a different path. So What kind of procedures have they found to be effective? I mean, you mentioned EFT, which is tapping. But what that sounds to me is like it doesn't have to be a big, long, drawn-out procedure, just something that kind of breaks the mental pattern. So maybe you could explain a little bit more about that.
Well, I think procedures are highly personal, and the procedure correlates to the specific circumstance. So, for example, someone at work that annoys you consistently would be a different procedure than worrying about money. And I think that your procedure has to be set up so that it works for you personally. And one of the things that I do when I'm trying to create a procedure is to ask myself, how would I handle this? And this obviously is away from the situation. How would I handle this? What would be the way that I would want to handle this if I could handle it in any way possible? If I had the choice of handling this any way possible. So this, you're thinking about this person that you know is consistently abrasive, and you say, okay, when this person comes in the room, it's basically a trigger to start this process. And if I could handle this person in any way and handle what they say and their personality in any way that I wanted, what would that be? You got to start there because you have to know where you want to end up. And once you have this idea of where you want to end up, then you can say, okay, well, what am I going to do to get from here, which is where I normally am when this starts, to over here? And that's when, you know, you would have to figure out something personal. I think that, like what you're talking about, like with the tapping and stuff, for some people that doesn't work, and sometimes it's not practical in a situation like that, you know, where you don't want to see people tapping on your earlobe or something. I don't know, maybe that would be okay for some people in some circumstances. But for me, I just find that when I look at the procedures, I find that they're very different in different areas. So, for example, when you're flying an airplane, you know, there's a separate procedure for an electrical problem than there is for when the engine quits. But somebody has taken the time to say, okay, what would be the best path once this emergency situation happens? And you go through that. Now, and then you write this down, and then that's what has become the standard for what you do in that situation. If you look at the world of golf, for example, you look at all of these performers have a pre-shot routine for every swing, for whether they're hitting their driver off the tee or whether they're putting or, you know, whatever their particular shot is, they have a separate procedure. Well, why is that? It's so that when they feel the stress of the competition and they feel like they have to particularly make the shot and their nerves are starting to build and they're beginning to get tight and worrisome and all that, they have some place where they can drop into where they feel safe. Now, is the pre-shot routine the same for every person? No. I mean, I've worked with athletes, and I can tell you that one pre-shot routine won't work for everybody. Everybody has to sit there and say, you know, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What makes me feel comfortable in these situations? What can I latch on to? So I don't know that, you know, I could answer that question with, oh, well, then you do this and you do that, and you do this, because I think those types of things, they just won't work across the board. And I also feel that when you start to look at yourself in that situation, you become more aware of yourself and how you react in these situations. When you're trying to solve this thing, you know, how do I want to react in this situation? What can I do to react in this situation? Then you really begin to get more in touch with yourself, what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, and you become more self-aware. You become more aware of what type of things bother you, how you have a tendency to react in certain situations. And I think that alone is very strengthening in terms of personal fortitude.
So really then what you're talking about is becoming aware of having a relationship, what I would call a sort of a conscious relationship with ourselves. And then once we're aware at that level, then we can begin to work with ourselves and partner with ourselves. I mean, that's really what you're talking about in creating these procedures.
That's very well put, Pamela. And that's a very succinct way of looking at it. You know, if you look at, you know, as a coach, when people come to you, you know, many times, you know, there are behaviors or reactions they have that, or internal dialogue that is happening, and they want to change. And that's one of the things that I'm sure you do. You know, you work with the person to get them more aware of, well, actually, I can personally say that you've done that for me. I mean, you make the person more aware of what is happening internally when they're in certain situations so that they can better understand themselves, and then they can formulate a procedure. You can call it a plan, but it's a procedure. Okay, when I begin to have this feeling, I want to recognize that this is something that I have repeated throughout my life or in certain situations. What is my best take to get out of this? How do I want to react in this situation? So, you know, you're doing that with the person, which, you know, is an assisted. That's where someone is helping someone to do this. But it's the same procedure.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that is it. And to your point, certainly when I'm talking to anyone, whether it be us as friends or coaching, it's always about creating something that is particular to the individual. There is no real cookie cutter way of dealing with that, because, you know, we're all a constellation of our experiences, our belief systems, our thought processes. So what works for one person may or may not work for another person. It's just really a matter of learning what works for ourselves as individuals, and then, you know, creating something customized for that.
Yes, exactly. And I also think that we need to touch for a minute or so on the whole concept of habits, because, you know, basically all of our behavior is habitual. I think that for most people, they're not even aware that their behavior is habitual, but it is. And I, you know, there's so much study going on now into habits, to understand how the brain forms them, why the brain forms them. And I can tell you that, you know, briefly, that if you look at your brain like a computer processor, one of the things that have realized now through the research is that your brain loves efficiency, because the more efficient it is, the more spare processor it has for creative and problem solving and all that sort of thing. So what it does is it looks for things that are repeated. And when it sees a behavior, and that behavior doesn't have to be physical, it can be a thought process that is repeated, it basically says, oh, here's something that I can make into a habit. And if I do that, I can go on autopilot for that. And then what will happen is I don't need to be so involved in that, and that frees up more processor for this kind of stuff over here. So the brain is always trying to do that, or the mind. And so if you understand that, then you begin to realize that when you react to a situation the same over and over again, your brain and your mind are basically saying, okay, this is something we need to habitualize to conserve processor energy. So it creates it. So many repetitions, and it becomes a habit. Now, that's the bad news. But the good news is that you can change the habit too. And if you understand that, then you can start to look at, and you're aware, you can start to look at, again, in the context of this conversation, how am I reacting to these situations? Because you can bet they're a habitual response. So once you know that, if you understand that if you come up with a new plan of how I want to react in this same situation, and you begin to repeat that reaction, it will become a habitual response. It will just like anything, you know, when you first start to change an aspect of your golf swing, when you first start to do it, it feels totally out of the normal. It feels uncomfortable. But as you do repetitions, the brain starts to groove that part in the swing. And they kind of talk about this in, like, in physical motions. It's like, you know, skiers skiing down a mountain in fresh packed snow, and their skis cut a groove in there. And then the skier goes back up to the top of the hill and goes back down the same path. And what ends up happening is it gets this hard packed groove in there. So what happens is it becomes harder and harder for the skier to get out of that groove. But once the skier decides to do that, then they start to move out of there, and it takes a little while for another groove to be cut. So in that interim process, it can feel crunchy, you know, it can feel kind of uncomfortable, and it feels like you're not getting anywhere, but you are. And if you understand that so many repetitions of a new behavior, a new way of thinking, will create a habitual response in that area. And I tell people, just repeat and relax. if you're repeating it, it will become a habit. You cannot stop it from becoming a habit. So then it becomes the habit forming begins to become an ally for you if you're conscious about what you're actually creating as a habit.
Well, I love that because basically what you're talking about is harnessing the power of habits. I mean, to your point, it's neutral. You know, habits are neutral. It's what we choose to do with that power that can either benefit us or not. And in fact, I am going to be having on the podcast Dr. BJ Fogg from Stanford, whose whole specialty is on habits. So our listeners should look for that episode because we're going to spend one whole episode just talking about the power of habits. So you're absolutely right. One other thing that I wanted to ask you about this, because all of this, you know, creating habits, you know, sort of moving into the process really, really kind of is dependent upon our wanting to do that. And sort of our relationship around that sometimes can be fraught because, you know, we're resistant and we don't want it. You know, in our world, you know, the idea of enjoying this is kind of not really supported. So how can we change our relationship with the practice or the process that it takes to build a new habit? How can we make it more fun instead of a chore?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if this is a really good answer for that, but I can explain how it happened for me. And, you know, years ago, I was trying to learn a particular run on the piano, a jazz improvisational run, and, you know, I couldn't do it. And because I couldn't do it, it wasn't any fun. And, you know, I had this idea, wouldn't it be great to be able to play this really fast run in my right hand when I was playing these chords in my left? Boy, it would sound so great, and the experience of doing it would really be satisfying. But every time I tried to do it, my hands just wouldn't do it. And so that created this caveat of, you know, I needed to practice, but I didn't feel like practicing it because just playing wasn't enjoyable. So what ended up happening was I worked at it for, I don't know, maybe a week and a half, and I didn't feel like I was getting anywhere with it. So I basically said, I've had enough, I can't do this, I'm just going to quit. And I was living alone then, this is many years ago, and what ended up happening was I ended up on a gig. I was playing with other musicians. And for some reason, in the middle of a particular piece of music when we were playing, I had the idea to play this riff. And so I just, you know, I just held my breath and I went after it. And it was there. I couldn't believe it. I didn't understand it. I thought, I can't believe it. I played it flawlessly. Well, what I realized later was that because I didn't understand how the brain works with this stuff, I had picked a goal and I had an unreasonable amount of time that I had arbitrarily chosen to accomplish this goal. You know, I figured I should be able to do this in a week. Well, that may be totally unreasonable for what has to happen chemically in the brain and everything to create the technical skill to do this. So what I learned from that, which really impacted me, was if I stopped reaching for this goal, where was the uncomfortable feeling come from? The uncomfortable feeling was coming from the fact that this is taking too long. I don't feel like doing this. When am I going to get to this point that's out there? And that kind of changed it for me because I realized that as long as I just kept working towards it in the moment, it would happen. And if I did that, what I found later was when I let go of this constant attachment to I have to be someplace other than where I am, in this particular case, it was developing this particular skill, it will happen a lot faster, and the experience of it happening won't be so uncomfortable. In fact, I'll just relax. And after that, I found that I began to apply that to everything that I was doing. And at times, I still have to fight with it because I may want to be expanding an area of my business, and I'll start to feel like this is happening, this is taking too long. And then I step back and I think, where am I getting this data from in terms of how long this should take? And, you know, a short story I used to tell to people was someone called me one time for coaching, and they were a middle-aged person that wanted to become a visual artist. And when I asked her what she was struggling with, She said, well, I decided to make a career change 6 months ago, and I wanted to become a visual, working in the visual arts. And so I said, that sounds wonderful. And she said, well, I'm not as good as I should be for 6 months. And I said, well, how good should you be? And there was just dead silence on the other end of the phone. And she said, I really don't know. And I said, well, if you don't know how good you should be after 6 months of effort, how do you know that you're not farther along than most people would be if they put in 6 months of effort? And she said, I never thought of it like that. And I said, well, if you could do what you can do now 6 months ago, would you feel like you were good? And she said, yeah, I would. And I said, so you're in this thing that we're all always in. We're always trying to be better. We're always trying to expand. We're always trying to grow. And we become attached on someplace other than where we are right now. And that creates this internal dialogue and uncomfortable feeling of, you know, I really can't be happy with where I am now. I want to be down here. And, you know, I tell people that's a beautiful blessing in our spirit, because it's the reason we don't live in caves anymore.
Right.
Because it's the part of us that wants to create. We want to grow. We want to expand. We want to be better. And that can either be a blessing and our friend, and we can embrace it, or it can be this thing that makes us constantly feel inadequate. So, you know, circling back, this is what, for me, was the realization of that, was what let all this anxiety in these situations go, because I actually experienced that, and I was aware enough to realize I was experiencing it, and I put it in my bank. And once I put that in my bank, when I start to have those feelings, I always review that and say, you know what, this is part of the journey, and this is part of the and the reason that we're always operating at our threshold. You know, we don't want to do what we can already do. We always want to do what we can't do. So we're always up against this threshold where we're when we're growing, and so we can accept that as it's great that we can expand and get better. Or it's like, I can't do this, and it's uncomfortable. So for me, that was really where that came from. And I guess what I'm saying is that once you begin to experience, just by shifting your perception of what am I actually experiencing, why am I feeling this way in a situation, and you begin to realize that it's a perception, it really changes the experience itself.
I love that. In fact, in my book, because this is something that I work with clients on continually, because, of course, when people want to embark on a career reinvention, they usually come in with kind of an artificial deadline in their head. And if they don't meet that deadline, then they're miserable, or there's this sense of artificial pressure. So I have a whole law. It takes the time that it takes. Like when people say, how long is this going to take? I was like, it takes the time that it takes. Like, just step into the process. And if you haven't set this, if you set that aside and you just focus on doing those things and you allow life to do its part, because certainly when you're reinventing yourself, you know, there are things that have to happen out in the world for you to have the opportunity that you want to have created. I mean, that's just it. And so if you can just step into that, it happens a lot faster, and you're certainly a lot happier, because instead of burning your energy on, you know, getting upset, you can use that time. I tell people, look, it's a gift. Do the things that are a part of the process, but then also, you know, use the time that you have, because you can volunteer, you can do some things that are fun. Like, consider it a gift, this break a gift, instead of being miserable because you're not already there. So I love that. Go on.
Well, I was going to say that is very well articulated. I like that.
Wonderful. Thank you. So anyway, I am mindful of the time, and I could just talk forever. I swear, I think I might have to just bring you back onto the podcast, because there's so many things else in your book, although it's not a long book. That's what I loved about it when I found it. It's very succinct, and there's not one wasted word in your book. And that's unusual, because there a lot of times it's a lot of filler, but your book is great, because it's just... it's so profound in a very efficient manner. So we're going to have to bring you back. But for those listeners, understand that it's 137 pages of incredible wisdom.
Thank you so much. And that was on purpose, because I figured I don't read real long books. That was something that I was really trying to do. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for acknowledging that.
Oh yeah. I'm a big, big fan now. Of the sub 150 page book, or it just doesn't take that long. Anything more than that? I mean, my book is longer than that, but I've got exercises, whatever. But in the future, I swear it's going to be short, because that's all it needs to be. All right, so I want to close by asking you a question. What two strategies do you use to lift your life?
I do two things. One is that I choose, well, first of all, I always spend time, the first thing would be I always spend time in quiet. I find that if I don't do that, that what will happen is my mind will start to gain momentum. And as it gains momentum, I start to become less aware of what it's doing. And, you know, one of the things that I've done with people is, you know, I tell them, look, I want you to just shut your eyes for 2 minutes and stop thinking. And when people do that, they realize that they can't stop thinking. And that's for the first time for many people, particularly in the Western world, where meditation and that sort of practice is slowly becoming more common. But what they realize is that their mind is a thought machine. That's what it does. It's a problem solver. If you don't give it a problem, it'll go looking for one. And so it's always looking for activity, and you have to use your will to actually slow it down. And I find that when I do that, my day always goes easier. I feel much more relaxed. I sleep better at night. So that's one thing that I do for myself that I find really improves the quality of my life. The other thing that I remind myself of is that I am very grateful for the fact that perfection is not a place you get to. It's because a place you get to or something you acquire is a limitation. Perfection for me is the ability to constantly grow and expand. And I always tell myself that. And when I do that, I release myself from the feeling that I'm going to get someplace where I'm going to be finally content. Because that's something that is driven into us through marketing. You know, you're incomplete, you need to get over here, and then life will be perfect. And, you know, we've all been through that our whole life, and we find that when we get to wherever this is, the new car, the cell phone, whatever it is, that we don't feel any differently than we did before. And I think that it creates a lot of turmoil inside. So I always, I find it very freeing to realize that I will always be expanding, and that is the way it should be. And for me, that is truly a gift.
Love that. Love, love, love that on so many levels. So thank you, Tom, for taking the time today to speak to us. And like I said, we will definitely have you back on the show.
I would love it, Pamela. Thank you so much.